This is WJBC This Week.
There have been over 350 mass shootings in America this year.
That video, shocking, terrifying.
We're doing things piecemeal. We can pass these things. We need to come to an agreement, get a full budget.
I didn't think that she was a good parent. I thought this was ridiculous.
I think her response was just the same, that they were looking for a reason to take him away from her.
Certainly in this time of budget uncertainty, these extra gifts are particularly critical just for the overall health and programmatic support and scholarship support of the university.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, we'll get reaction to the fallout from the police shooting of Laquan McDonald in Chicago and the more than year-long investigation that followed. A former homeless veteran aims to help other veterans who have fallen on hard times. A historian discusses the role that alcohol has played in shaping American history. A jeweler-turned-filmmaker brings his latest work to Bloomington Normal. Plus, Grammy Award-winning country singer Susie Boggess comes to Bloomington Normal for a performance. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. The fatal shooting of Laquan McDonald, the black teenager who was shot 16 times by a Chicago police officer, and the investigation that followed have raised many questions. Mayor Rahm Emanuel fired Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy this week, but an expected federal probe into how the department and the city handled the case means the matter is far from resolved, as an officer was charged with the murder 13 months after the incident. Chief Operating Officer of the advocacy group Reboot Illinois, Madeline Dubeck, talked with WJBC's Dan Swaney this week.
What do you make of Gary McCarthy taking the fall for this?
You know, I think Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago, is under an extreme amount of pressure over this shooting and the video not being released for 400 days, and the fact that there was a settlement offered to the family of this young man before a lawsuit was even filed, and it happened to be in April when the mayor was facing a very competitive runoff election. And so the pressure has just continued to mount. There have been protests every day since the video was released. That is just a hideous thing to have to watch. And I urge everyone to take a look at it, because I do really think you need to see it in order to be able to have an appreciation for this situation. And so apparently he had, the mayor was sticking by him and just kind of rethought everything overnight. And the report is that he was even on the radio up here in Chicago this morning and thought he was fine, and then had a chat with the mayor, and now he's gone.
That's the thing that I'm still stunned by, is how quickly this happened. You didn't get a hint of it at all until it landed late this morning, did you?
You really didn't. It really seemed like the mayor was going to stick by McCarthy, and the two of them tried to put as positive a spin on this as you can in a situation like this at a press conference before the video was released. And I think it'll be interesting to see whether this satisfies the public, because, you know, a lot of people out there believe that this video was timed and kept under wraps so that it wouldn't harm the mayor's reelection chances, and there are an awful lot of people, as you pointed out, also calling for the resignation of the Cook County State's Attorney, who is herself facing election. She's got a primary in March.
Was Gary McCarthy, before this happened this week with the release of the video, what was he thought of? How was he thought of in Chicago?
There certainly have been calls from aldermen who represent predominantly black communities in Chicago, who had been calling for his resignation before this, because there has been, just enormous, for years now, horrible deaths of gang members killing children to get back at other gang members, and, you know, the whole thing that's kind of the subject of the Chirac movie by Spike Lee, where not enough is being done to control gangs and black-on-black violence in Chicago.
You mentioned the video, and this is I've seen the video, and when I saw it the first time, I was stunned. I I've watched it several times, so I'm not going to say I just watched it once and went away. It's a video that is, if you say sobering, I don't think that's strong enough, but it certainly does make you stop and think.
It really does, and I hope, you know, I know a lot of us come to a situation like this with our own biases, and they can be very strong, and I just believe that you really have to watch the video to fully appreciate what happened here, and it just defies reasonableness and the expectation. And, you know, I wrote a column about it over the weekend, and my take is, you know, that it could have been much more graphic. I had actually braced myself in some ways for something much more graphic and worse. But the thing about it is that it really stays with you and haunts you, and I think it challenges your perception of police power and proper policing and, you know, everything people were told about what happened in this situation before that video was released seems to be false. And it does seem that this young man, obviously troubled, but he's 17 years old. I don't really think that what his background is has, frankly, any relevance in this situation. And he was running down the middle of the street, and a police officer who was a good, I don't know, 10 yards away from him, would you say, Dan?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'd be pretty close, yeah.
Just opened fire on him and unloaded 16 bullets into him. And
in 15 seconds. It's like it happened so quickly that you just couldn't believe that it had happened.
Right. And, you know, just 16 bullets in 15 seconds into a 17-year-old.
Yeah. Who really, they had been following this kid for a while, and he led him on a little, like, U-turn around a building, and then he went into the middle of the street, and there were police all over the place that were blocking off roads, and he ran down the street. He seemed to take something out of his pocket, and it's conflicting what it was he took out of his pocket. Some think it was a knife, some think it wasn't, but nevertheless, he was gunned down. There was no doubt in my mind. Here's another thing about that video. This happened over a year ago, and it's just now coming to light. How could that possibly have happened?
That is the thing that is, frankly, in some ways more troubling than the young man being gunned down, which I don't mean to discount that.
Mm-hmm.
But what we have here is a situation, again, where we're electing people and they're appointing people and putting them in positions like police superintendent, and then they're going about trying to essentially keep things from us because they have the control and the power to do so. So the citizen could ask for this video and get turned down, and citizens did ask for this video and got turned down. And, you know, the mayor and his administration and the police department and the state's attorney all fought the release of this video, and it took a judge to order its release 13 months after the fact, and it took that long for this police officer to be charged.
And if you put that along with a missing piece of video from a nearby Burger King, it was almost an hour and a half of video, it kind of smacks to a lot of people of a police and or city cover-up.
It certainly, I mean, you know, it's hard to reach any other conclusion, frankly. I suppose it's possible that all those things could have happened innocently, but it sort of defies reasonable, logical conclusion.
That was Madeline Dubeck of Reboot Illinois with Dan Sweeney.
America has a long and complicated history with alcohol, from how it was viewed and consumed by our founding fathers, to prohibition, to the economic stimulant it is today. Susan Shever, the author of Drinking in America, Our Secret History, talked with WJBC's Steve Fast this week.
You say that alcohol was often a silent third party when it came to many of the decisions that changed American history. Of course, a lot of that has to do with economics and social organization, but sometimes people were just drunk and made decisions that would change our history. This is overlooked quite a bit.
Well, I think it is overlooked. In fact, I think that often history overlooks the things that most interest me, which are food, sex, clothes, and drinking. So I think history in the 21st century tends to take a broad view and leave out the everyday details. And of course, in doing that, it leaves out many of the things that actually influence the overall view. So I like to make, or I like to try to make, history come alive. That's my personal goal as a writer, and to take the pictures off the wall and make them dance. And so as part of that, I began to look a little more deeply into what makes history happen, and what I found is that very often there was a drink there.
We do learn a little bit more about figures that have been written about a great deal by looking at their relationship with alcohol, and it's not just drinkers, but people that abstained as well. You write about Abraham Lincoln, and there are some interesting things in your book about how Lincoln approached alcohol.
Well, Lincoln is very much the hero of my book, although, of course, he's only in one chapter. But Lincoln was a man who didn't drink. His mother had told him on her deathbed that she hoped he wouldn't drink. And he wasn't an alcoholic, but he wasn't a temperance crusader either. He didn't drink, but he didn't judge. And when we were losing the Civil War, Lincoln fired his sober general, George McClellan, and hired a man who had already been almost court-martialed for drinking, generally Ulysses S. Grant. He wasn't a general then. And Lincoln understood that Grant, with all his flaws, including drinking, was a brilliant, brilliant general. And when people came to Lincoln and complained that Grant drank too much and complained that Grant would go missing because of drinking, Lincoln said to those people, bring me 3 barrels of what Grant drinks so that I can give it to all my other generals. In other words, Lincoln understood that Grant's drinking was a necessary part of Grant's brilliant personality as a warrior. So Lincoln is this amazing thing that I think we should all aim to be, the person who doesn't drink particularly, but who also doesn't look down on people who do drink.
The Pilgrims' desire for a drink was a factor in their settlement. I was surprised to find out the Pilgrims were big drinkers, first of all.
Well, they couldn't drink water, so they had to drink beer. Water wasn't safe to drink in 1620. So instead of water, they drank beer. So they drank quite a lot of beer. They drank, the ration was a gallon a day of 0.6 beer for everyone on the Mayflower. And famously, they landed on Cape Cod because they were running out of beer. Their charter from the king was for Virginia. They knew they had to get to Virginia. They tried to sail south to Virginia. They couldn't make it. Their landfall was on Cape Cod, so they went back and landed on Cape Cod, even though they knew that they didn't have the right to land there. And of course, they picked a dinky little harbor halfway between two of the great harbors in the world, New York and Boston. And they had a terrible time. In the first winter after the Mayflower landed, half of the Pilgrims died. Their original landing on Cape Cod, the urgency of their needing to land was partly because they were running out of beer, as William Bradford wrote. And they not only were running out of having enough beer to keep everybody's thirst slaked on board, but Captain Jones of the Mayflower was worried because he wanted to have enough beer to get his crew back to England. So really from the beginning, the American character was formed by the fact that, in this case, the Pilgrims were worried that they might run out of beer. And of course, that we landed on Cape Cod made a huge difference in what kind of people we turned out to be.
Looking at history through the lens of drinking in America. Did your personal feelings about alcohol provide any context or fuel for your desire to look at these incidents this way?
Well, I'm certainly fascinated by addiction and recovery, and I'm also fascinated by American history. So the collision of these two passions of mine, the result of that collision is this book. I grew up in an alcoholic family. I'm an alcoholic in recovery. So, of course, I have a personal interest, but what I was just surprised over and over again as I did the research for this book, although I come from an alcoholic family, I had no idea that the family of John Adams was a tragic, doomed alcoholic family. I didn't realize that John Adams lost two sons and two grandsons to alcoholism and alcoholic accidents in one case. I mean, a loss like that is unimaginable. It means that John Quincy Adams, who was the president of the United States, lost two brothers and two sons to alcoholism, and they didn't know then what we know now. So, you know, when Ralph Waldo Emerson said that John Quincy Adams acted as if he drank sulfuric acid for breakfast, I have to say to myself, no wonder he acted that way. The losses he had sustained because of drinking were really, I'm sure, unbearable.
You mentioned the family ties. Your father, John Cheever, many people know, was a writer. And there seems to be a tie, at least romantically, between writers and drinkers. Why do you think that is?
Well, this was one of the things in the book that really surprised me the most. I had always thought there was a tie in American literature between writing and drinking, and of course there are many books that make that argument. But what I realized doing the reading and the research is that it's not true. That tie was only true for the two generations of writers after Prohibition. Now, follow me here. In the 19th century, the writers who wrote American literature, Melville, Hawthorne, Emerson, Thoreau, Emily Dickinson, the Alcotts, Longfellow, they didn't drink. They weren't teetotalers. They drank occasionally, but they were not drinkers. So the men and women who wrote American literature, Margaret Fuller, were not drinkers. And now, these days, writers don't drink. John Irving, Donna Tartt, Jonathan Franzen, whoever, they're not drinkers. So when I saw that, I was really amazed, because this whole idea that in order to write well you have to drink really just comes out of two generations of men and women right after Prohibition.
That was historian Susan Cheever with Steve Fast. A nationally acclaimed movie producer was in Bloomington Normal this week for a private showing of a documentary on the romance of the jewelry business from the perspective of a third-generation jeweler. Producer Oren Mazzoni's film, called Sharing the Rough, is a mine-to-market look at how gemstones are unearthed in East African nations of Tanzania and Kenya. Mazzoni talked with WJBC's Susan Saunders this week.
It shows that it's a country that is rich in gem minerals, and they're just starting to create their infrastructure. And if it's done correctly they can continue to grow and mine these gemstones, they could do very well for themselves.
Can't have a conversation about jewelry without thinking of one of our favorite jewelers. And as we're celebrating, so you know, our 90th anniversary here at WJBC, one of our longest running sponsors is Jack Lewis Jewelry. And Jack Lewis Jewelers, name changed a little bit in there. I always say it wrong. Jack Lewis Jewelers, number one top guy, is also here in studio, and that would be the amazing John Carter. How did this come about that you two met each other and created this special event at the Normal Theater tomorrow night, John?
Oren and I are both privileged enough to, we both kind of grew up in this industry. He through his family, and I started working at Jack Lewis, as you know, as a young man in high school. And we kind of inadvertently knew each other in those days. But I was honored because I got to see this film for the very first time that it was shown publicly in Tucson, Arizona, during the Gem Fair that goes on every January and February out there. And it was me and Oren and probably about 90 other people. And it was kind of his unveiling to the industry of, look at this cool story that I've told that really at first glance, I thought would be for us, people who know the industry. But it didn't take me long in the theater to realize what this thing really translates and will speak to the education of our consumers about what it takes to go from mine to market. In this case, a green garnet from East Africa to the cutter, to the jewelry designer, which is one of our favorite people, Mark Schneider, to the end consumer, and from dirt to wearable art, it is pretty amazing, and he captures the passion of it.
That's amazingly. Actually one of the parts of the story I'm most interested in is the cutters, because after you've told me multiple times about your adventures in Antwerp, going over with the yearly trip to try and bring back diamonds, and you're sorting through sometimes raw diamonds and then some of the others. When you were filming this, Oren, were you nervous that at times you were going to come across things that were going to be uncomfortable for your family, audience members of jewelers and gemologists?
Well, you know what? I actually wasn't, because I knew the area. I studied the area before because I didn't. You know, I wanted to make sure that the story was true and completely organic. And I also wanted to make sure that we were in an area that was safe. Mm-hmm. Okay, and we had. Let's see. We had probably 12, 15 people with us, and they were gem cutters. They were consumers, and they really made the documentary what it is. I was never worried that the jewelry industry or anything like that, or my family's jewelry store was going to be shown in a negative light. You know, if that's what you mean, because there's you know, there's really more. There's 10-to-1 places on, you know, that show the beauty and the passion behind the miners, and you know, the miners in East Africa, they represent a lot of artisanal miners across the world. So,
do they consider it an art form instead of just a job? And a passion?
I would say they consider it a passion, most definitely. But it is a job, you know.
Is it like being a hunter? You know, where I'm always trying to find something bigger, something better than I've ever discovered before. And will this next discovery of a gem be the best one I've ever discovered?
Oh yeah. One of the funnest parts was, we know in the film where the gem came from. And we know the person that actually found it, and it's a young man. He was probably in his late 20s, and we lovingly call him Buddha, as well as his family calls him Buddha. And he's on I captured him, and one of the cool things was I did not know documentary. It's run and gun, so I did not know the individual person that found it. We knew the mine, and we're inside of the mine, and I'm filming. And, so the mine manager says, my son is the one that found it. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, he's sitting right here. So, then I turn my camera on him and I'm like, tell me about it. And this guy's just got this big smile on his face, and he's like, we knew we found something really special. And he loved it. And you could tell that there was passion in his eyes.
I would have no idea that they would even know specifically what stones they have found. So the story in Sharing the Rough, which is a movie directed by my guest here today, Oren Mazzoni, and is a special engagement thanks to Jack Lewis Jewelers, and we'll tell you how to get tickets in a second. I would have no idea that they would even be able to keep track of who found what. What is so unusual about this one particular stone? Is it very, very large? Is it ultimate clarity?
Well, it's actually both combined with the rarity of it. So it was a very large stone. It was very clean, and it's very rare. So put those three things together, and you have something very special.
And the color is incredible.
And you said it's a garnet?
Yeah, it's a green garnet.
And so is this the first time that Buddha has ever discovered what his gem find, what it turned into, getting to see the finished product?
Oh yeah, this was the biggest gem that has ever come out of that mine to that time. I'm not sure what's happened in the past year. We filmed in January 2014, So there, you know, there could be something bigger since, but this was a 50-carat piece of rough.
Oh my goodness,
right.
that's a large stone.
It's huge.
That was producer Oren Mazzoni with Susan Saunders. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Kevin Wilkerson knows what homeless veterans need to get back on their feet. That's because he was one. Living in a car with his kids for about 9 months, he discovered Building Lives, a group that offers mentoring, health and psychological care, and employment services. And it's getting financial help from the bike candy sale at the Interstate Center this week. Wilkerson now works for Building Lives, and he talked with WJBC's Dan Swaney this week.
What do the veterans need more than anything, other than, you know, some love and support, maybe?
Right.
But what do they need? What do you hear most often?
Most often I hear just a chance. You know, a lot of men and women get out of the military needing help. Too proud to ask for it, and by the time they do ask for it, they're kind of in a situation that's one of those dire straits kind of things, and they just end up homeless. You know, we run into veterans who are single mothers who gotten out maybe through divorce, job layoffs, unemployment, who end up that way. We run into veterans with substance abuse issues. I mean, just across the gamut, the same issues that affect most of society.
You know, you used the word pride a while ago,
right.
And I have to believe that may be the biggest hurdle to get over for many people.
It is. It was the biggest for me.
Yeah. Well, let's hear your story, because
sure.
You talk about somebody who's working now to help the lives of other homeless vets. You were a homeless vet.
Sure. I was a homeless veteran and single father back in 07. I left Ohio, transferred to Tennessee with a job. The job during the housing bubble crisis fell into bankruptcy, went out of business, and I was homeless. You know, no funds, no transportation, and it was you know, only for a short period of time, maybe 9 months. So we basically slept in my car, used rest stops, you know, showered at pilot gas stations, and I was fortunate enough to run into Tim Gregoth and Building Lives and change my life.
And you did this not by yourself. You did it with some children.
Yes. Yes, I was a single father. I had my youngest son and an older son. And it was a difficult time.
How did you do it?
Well,
other than what you just said with the basic stuff, but mentally and spiritually,
well,
how
you know,
did you do it?
When you're a man, you don't get in touch with the communication sensitive side until you find yourself in situations where you're in dire straits. And for me, the most difficult part was I refused to apply for food stamps. I refused to accept unemployment, those type of things, because I always felt that there were people who needed that, and I didn't. You know, I was I had 2 years of college, and I was at that time trying to finish my bachelor's out at MTSU, which is Middle Tennessee State University. And I decided that for me and my children, it was best that I continued my education as opposed to trying to get back into the job market. And that's the route I chose to take. You know, I figured I only had 9 months left. I'd rather sleep in my car and make that sacrifice. So I can provide a better life for them.
A lot of people said you made your sacrifice. You filled up your sacrifice quota by just being in the military.
Yes.
What branch were you at?
I was in the Air Force.
Yeah.
And I'm a Desert Storm vet. And I did 3 tours in Desert Storm. I also participated in the Panama activities, Grenada activities. And, you know, people in the military know what those were. But, you know, they were years ago. But I've seen my share of combat.
How long were you in the military?
I did 10 years.
All right.
Active duty.
Mm-hmm. So you're in your car, and you've just come out from a pilot truck stop from getting cleaned up, you and your boys.
Mm-hmm. I drop them off at school, pick them up in the evening. We spend time in the library, getting their home assignments done, and that's how we live.
When did it change?
It changed when I met Tim Gregoth. I was taking some courses at American Baptist College, and one of the doctors at the university kind of knew my circumstances, and He was trying to find veterans to help. He was a Vietnam veteran. His father was a World War II veteran. And it was a blessing from God.
And he's the guy behind Building Lives. Yes, so
it was his concept, his idea, his initial drive that put all of this together.
What did they do to get you back on your feet?
Basically, what they did was provide housing for me and my children. They assisted me in my tuition, books for my final. The 9 months ended up being about 15 before I completed my bachelor's degree, and found me job placement. Actually, I was going to be working with HCA, which is very big in Nashville, Hospital Corporation of America, and at the same time, I felt an obligation to show the love that Tim had showed me to some other veterans in need. And that idea just grew. And I just decided to dedicate myself to helping Tim as opposed to getting back in the corporate the world.
Sure. What was it like the first night you went into a home to sleep?
For me, you know, it's emotional. And it's emotional now even thinking about it because you think you're a better person. And when you're in a homeless situation, you kind of lose that pride, you lose that self-esteem, and it was just overwhelming for me because I put my children through a lot, you know, and to not have a mother, that was enough, but, you know, to deal with me trying to finish school and handle those responsibilities, there was an overwhelming relief. And an overwhelming joy knowing that people in this country still care about veterans.
That was Kevin Wilkerson of Building Lives with Dan Swaney. Long before Susie Boggess became a Grammy Award-winning country music singer and songwriter, she was a student first at Illinois Wesleyan and then Illinois State University, where she graduated with a degree in metalsmithing, which she later used to design her own jewelry. She played at the Castle Theater in Bloomington on Friday and talked with WJBC's Tim Lewis this week.
You've sang for everybody and their dog and in places far and wide. Goodness. And you sang for President Clinton. Command performance. That must have been fun.
Well, it was really fun. But the biggest reason for me that it was so much fun was the company I was keeping. It was, you know, I sang there with Ted Atkins and Alison Krauss and Kathy Matea and we just, you know, we had a heck of a time. And then the Clintons gave us a White House tour.
A tour, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The quarters upstairs. And you know, President Clinton is a real history buff, so it was really like getting a history lesson and cocktails all at the same time. It was awesome, yeah.
Oh, man, I can't imagine that. I would, you know, I'm a big Alison Krauss fan, too, so that...
Oh, me too.
I just love her voice.
Well, she's a good Illinois girl.
Yes.
So, you know, I got to extra super love her.
You too. Have you ever sang with her? Have you ever had the opportunity?
Yeah, she's sung on a bunch of my records, and I haven't ever sung on anything of hers, but, we've known each other since I think she was about 18 or 19.
So no kidding.
Long time. And her husband, her ex-husband, Pat Bergeson, played in my band for 21 years. So yeah, I kind of know her pretty well.
Wow. All right, we got to go back to probably even before 1980, because that's when you graduated college, right, at ISU?
Yes.
Tell me when you first got the bug, because we all do. I was a singer. At 18 years of age, I had to make a choice, either go play college football I had the opportunity to have a actually sang. This is going to sound really bad. A person that I knew in my high school choir is cousins with David Gates of Bread.
Nice.
And I did all the ballads as in high school, and I could sound like that back in the 80s. You and I are basically the same age. And
wow.
So I had that sound, and so she introduced me to him when we went on a choir tour to California.
Wow.
And had that opportunity, and he gave me his card of his producer and everything. Back then, you didn't have The Voice or American Idol,
yeah.
And so it was...
Kind of just went through
that. So when did you first start and understand that's your calling?
Well, I went to Wesleyan my freshman year, and my sophomore year, I transferred to ISU because I went into metals and in the art department. And it was there at ISU that I realized that I wanted to try to play out in front of people. And I started playing at the gallery, which lots of people from that time period were playing at the gallery. It was kind of a coffee house vibe, but it was more of a little pub and just real homey and, you know, lots of other singer-songwriters and guitar players and that hanging around there all the time. So I learned a lot from those people and you know, really, you know, picked up a lot of my stage, my savvy, my footlight savvy from those guys over there at the gallery.
Tell everybody the story about the first paycheck you picked up. You were pretty young, but and it was in town. Tell us about that.
Well, I tease about this, but it is the truth. I know that Spike, the fellow who was running and owning the place at the time, would probably, you know, beg to differ with me. But my first paycheck was $7 and all the beer and pizza that I could hold. So
I
always say that he got a pretty bad deal because, you know, I was in college and I could eat a lot of pizza and drink a lot of beer. So,
of course. You're a college kid. College kids do that well.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I couldn't hold that now. Neither one of them.
Now your mom was musical, yes?
Yeah, my mom's musical. She's 93, still sings in the choir, still, you know, hangs out with her friends. And sometimes they do talent shows and stuff like that. And I have a niece that went to Wesleyan that is an opera singer. She's currently in New York doing an audition for the Met, but she's in a contract in Germany right now for the next 3 or 4 years. And so she comes back to the States and does little, you know, little tours over here while she, you know, cause I think she's doing San Francisco sometime this year and maybe the Met. So she's really climbing the ladder. Her name is Rebecca Davis. And if anybody remembers listening to little Becky Davis singing at Wesleyan, she's done quite well for herself.
There you go. Now your mom being musical like she was, did you and all your siblings, were you all musical?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, everybody, you know, we all played the drums in the band. You know, that was kind of the deal back then was that, you know, the teacher always picked, you know, what you should play. You know, you go in and you try on the clarinet or you try out the saxophone or whatever. And for some reason, my whole family ended up with drums. I think we were just a kind of a rowdy bunch. So all four of us played the drums in the band and you know, did the marching band, the whole thing. And then I made my kid do the marching band because I just thought he would have a really great experience like I did. And he was in Indiana, you know, got to go to the finals and everything. So it was a pretty big deal.
That was Susie Baugus with Tim Lewis. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. The Bloomington mother accused of endangering her child before he was murdered 2 years ago by the mother's boyfriend has pleaded guilty. Danielle Fisher could get up to 10 years in prison for contributing to the death of 3-year-old Robbie Kramer. During Fisher's trial, Alyssa Thorndike, the sister of Kramer's biological father, says she noticed injuries a week before the boy died, including one on his finger that was described as a pinch.
And I looked at his finger and I said, "That is not a pinch. That is a burn." And it basically looked like the flesh was melted off his fingers.
Fisher's boyfriend at the time, Nicholas Compton, was convicted of first-degree murder and is serving life in prison. Governor Rauner says the video of Laquan McDonald being shot 16 times by a Chicago police officer brought him to tears.
I cried. That video, shocking, terrifying. I cried for the young man who was brutally shot. Cried for the thousands of police officers who are honest and hardworking.
Rauner says he would support a federal Justice Department probe into the Chicago Police Department. Senator Dick Durbin called the mass shootings in San Bernardino, California this week horrific and said something needs to be done to combat gun violence. More from Will Stevenson.
Speaking on the Senate floor not long after 14 people were killed and more than 14 were injured, Durbin said with more than 350 mass shootings in the U.S. this year, that should tell you something.
Our thoughts and prayers are with the victims and first responders in San Bernardino. But they and all the victims across our country deserve more than our thoughts and prayers. They deserve action.
And that action, Durbin says, should be level-headed and bipartisan and should address gun violence. Will Stevenson, WJBC and WJBC.com.
Local governments could soon be getting some long-awaited state money as Illinois lawmakers have passed a spending bill. But State Senator Jason Barrickman tells WJBC's Dan Swaney this is good and bad.
The negative is that as we continue to see a piecemeal approach to the budgeting process move forward, the big picture still leaves many issues unresolved.
Illinois is now in its sixth month without a budget. And Illinois State University raised more than $550,000 in donations on Giving Tuesday, far outpacing last year's total. ISU's Director of Annual Giving, Laura Way.
It was a great example of how this community has come together in support of Illinois State and its students, and we couldn't be more pleased with the results.
There were more than 1,400 individual donors. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, a transition center to help displaced Mitsubishi Motors employees will open in Normal as production at the plant stopped last week. Normal's town council will consider a redevelopment proposal for the Holiday Inn in North Normal on Monday night. On Wednesday, the Unit 5 and District 87 school boards will hold their final meetings of 2015. And on Friday, there will be a job fair for displaced Mitsubishi employees at Heartland Community College. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.